Well. It's amazing, not so many questions today. Must mean you know all the answers already. Hope I know the answers. So here we go, question number one, question time. Because sometimes when I give talks, sometimes that they're to the point, sometimes they're what you really want to know, but there's also some things you'd always miss when you give talks, so it's nice to have the opportunity to have question time after. So they don't have to be on sort of meditation, they can be on anything to do with Buddhism. So question time on the evening time. Anything you'd like to know about Buddhism, but always afraid to ask. Even though I let go of thinking as much as possible, thoughts continue to spring up as if they have an inertia built up over time. What is the most effective way of dealing with this? Okay, to overcome thinking, you have the method which I was indicating this morning, is actually try and see through thinking, to see it as not something pleasant, not something which is going to bring you happiness, not something which is going to bring you wisdom. Actually, to how many years have you been thinking? And where's it got you so far? Okay, it's good in your job, but in actually life, in real life, and in especially in spiritual life, in Buddhism, in meditation, it misses the point all the time. And I think that's something Rinzai said that, Lin Chi, all thinking misses the point, all movement of mind goes to a contrary end. It never actually gets to the point, it's always just mere words, descriptions, like menus describing food, travel diaries, travel books describing places. It's just all words and thoughts, descriptions, and as I mentioned this morning, it's all dead stuff, thoughts. Never lie, never right to the point of what's happening now, which is usually beyond thought. It's actually to see what thought is and to see the illusion of thought. Your thinking promises that it will bring you some solutions and some answers to the problems of life. But all the thinking does, it just goes round and round in circles and just makes more questions. It doesn't answer questions, it just makes more. So first of all, like to see just the danger of thinking, the negativity of thinking, it doesn't lead anywhere. And then there's an opportunity to actually to reject it. The mind will see there's something better. And the second part of this is see the danger in thinking and see the benefit in silence. So every moment you have some silence, every time and occasion there's no thinking going on in the mind. Just really get in and enjoy that. It's just so peaceful, it's just so nice not to have thinking going on. It's like you're suddenly free. It's like you've been living with one of these teenagers who likes rap music all the time. And now that rap music has been turned off and turned down. Or, you know, the teenager's gone to some sort of concert somewhere and you've got a couple of hours in your house of absolute silence and peace. Oh, isn't that lovely? This is actually what the rapper inside is, you know, your head. You know, there's rap music going on inside. This is meditation rap now. Now, that sort of thing just drives you crazy after a while. So when it stops and is silence, just know how beautiful silence is. How awesome, and I use that word carefully, just full of awe, is silence. How beautiful, how calming, how pregnant of truth silence is. And if you have any feeling for the spiritual traditions of our world, you know that all wisdom and truth is found in silence. And the great monks, nuns, spiritual sages all go off into silent places to get their wisdom. They go off to mountains, to deserts, to lonely places, to inaccessible monasteries in the jungle, where it's silent, there's no thoughts, nothing going on. There to be able to listen, free from thought, free from speech, free from all of these duties in our world, free from all of these things. So we have time to listen, to feel, to know the truth. Because thinking is like that curtain which blocks you from seeing the truth. You have to shut up the thinking. And when there's silence, there you can find truth. But also silence has, you know, when there's no thinking going on, it has this beautiful feeling attached to it. It's pleasant to be silent. And the more one could acknowledge that pleasantness and recognize it, enjoy it, the easier it is to be silent. Because it's what the Buddha called like the inclinations of the mind. Now, there's a mind inclines to where it thinks it's going to find pleasure. You know, if you've got pleasure from thinking before, in fantasies and dreams and plans or whatever, then the mind will incline there again and again and again, because it thinks, or rather it perceives, that that's where it will find some happiness. But if every time you're silent you can remember that, just how enjoyable that was, then that means that the mind will be inclining even more to silence in the future. So by recognizing the beauty in it, the peace, the happiness, the joy, you're actually training the mind to go back there again and again and again. That's why in the last few days, or last few weeks in Nalamara, I've been encouraging people to do a little technique in the beginning of meditation. There's all sorts of little tricks of the trade which I impart on retreats like this, which I've been using over the years. And that is actually to remind yourself, or remember, recall a time and a place in your life so far where you have been quiet. The most peaceful time of your life. The time of greatest contentment. Whatever that was. Just remember that. Bring it to mind. And as you recall the place and time of greatest contentment in your life, the greatest peace, the greatest silence, just imagine the details of that time. Where it was. What it looked like. What was happening. And when you actually bring to mind the details of that event, you find you'll also pull in the silence as well. You'll have the contentment there, the peace. It'll be with you again. What you're doing is having a quick method of recalling silence. Because the time of greatest silence and peace in your life was a very happy time, was a very moving time, a very beautiful time. All you need to do is to say to the mind, remember that. Recall that, relive it. When you relive it, it's as if you're teaching the mind once more that silence is just so beautiful, so wonderful. The thing is, you can't make the mind silent. You can't say, you know, shut up mind, because that's more thinking. This is the problem, you know, the old joke of the, you know, the four monks in silence. And one monk sneezes, and the other monk says, bless you. The second monk says, you've broken your vow of silence. The third monk says, so have you. And the fourth monk says, I'm glad I'm the only one here who can keep my vow. The thing is, you can't make yourself silent. It's just, you know, every time that you interrupt and say, be silent, you're not being silent. This is actually the difference between letting go and doing. You can't do letting go. You have to stop the doing. And then letting go happens. You can't do letting go. You can't say, be quiet. You just have to be quiet. And so, understanding this, you understand that you can't make your mind silent. All you can do is actually teach your mind, incline your mind towards silence. By every time there's a nice piece of silence, recognizing that as beautiful, as happy. And you find the mind will incline towards that happiness. And the third thing is actually make sure you're not afraid of silence. And this is the third obstacle here, fear. Because in silence, people can feel very vulnerable. Either because it's unfamiliar territory, they haven't been silent very much in their life, so they're not used to it. And what we're not used to, we usually feel afraid of. There's a deeper reason for that fear there, because when we haven't got this mind thinking, we're actually abandoning a little bit of control. Abandoning sort of, you know, our security system of thinking and evaluating and judging. And that takes a bit of courage to be silent and to have the confidence you'll be safe in silence. It's one of the reasons why we do this on a meditation retreat in a centre like this. This is one of the safest places in the world right now. You're not being judged, you don't have to do anything. It's just so and everyone's on really high precepts, all really, really good people. They weren't good people, you wouldn't allow them into this retreat. There are no psychotic maniac killers on this retreat, I guarantee. At least I hope so. So because of that, you can feel so safe on this retreat. Now, most of you, you know each other, you know me for years, it's like being with friends. And that means give you a sense of safety and confidence, you can let go a bit more than you would be able to do otherwise. So that's the third thing, to watch out the silence. Watch out the fear. A lot of times we have a bit of silence and then we get afraid, we disturb it on purpose. Because you know, we're not ready for it, we're not familiar with it, it feels a bit unsafe. So in order to solve these problems, I've just been programming you. Programming you to see the danger in thinking, see the negative parts of thinking, not to delight in thinking so much. Programming you to delight in this opposite silence, and to value silence. And also program you to make sure that if fear comes up, somebody will say, no, no, this is okay. I don't mean verbally, subverbally. It will give silence a chance. And after a while, when silence starts to grow, it becomes such a wonderful abiding that the mind just will not be able to disturb it with a thought. It will be just like you're watching your favourite movie and say your husband comes up and starts to disturb you. Shh, shut up! Something's going to happen. Now you won't tolerate any disturbance when you're really enjoying silence. The thought will come in the mind and it will just get evaporated. It won't be able to last because you're enjoying the silence too much. So if you get into the silence and enjoy it, and then you'll find, don't have the fear of it. And after a bit of training, you'll find that the thoughts will not come in the mind. When you say the thoughts, people used to say they have like a mind of their own, the thoughts just come. The thoughts don't just come, you invite them in. I see that in my own mind. I think, oh, the thought, where do they come from? I thought, that's me. Don't blame anybody else. And actually, you invite them in because you want to disturb yourself. And so, give yourself something to do. So, see if you can just trust in the silence. Feel at ease with doing nothing. And then thinking will get less and less and less. And when thinking gets less and less and less, you get wiser and wiser and wiser. He who thinks doesn't know. He who knows doesn't think. You ever thought that? Didn't know. Okay, any other questions about thinking? What do you think about that? Okay. Sure. Dear Ajahn, I often want to meditate at night, but I find that when I do this, I can't sleep. The meditation is good, but I toss and turn all night. Next morning, I'm really tired. Have not been able to sleep. Is this normal? Nighttime is the best time for me, but it is counterproductive. Okay, well it's nice to actually meditate at night time, but when you meditate at night time, do the meditation you're doing now, but when you go to sleep, do letting go meditation. So letting go meditation, just present moment awareness and silence. Because the thing is, you toss and turn all night because you're trying to go to sleep. This is one of the things which are problems which I've had sometimes. You know, you get a nice meditation, get really sort of bright, and you've got to go to sleep because, you know, you've got to give a talk the following day or go somewhere, perform. And, you know, if I'm really tired, you can't perform very well. And all the people come there and they want you to give a nice talk or whatever. So, the only way I deal with this is to, you know, when I had a good meditation and go to sleep at night, I don't try to go to sleep. I just lay down there, present moment awareness, just being here, go to silence, and I don't worry. Go to sleep, fine. If I don't go to sleep, fine. Especially on a retreat, I mean, you'd be sitting down on these cushions, and after a while, after a whole day, it gets very sore, doesn't it? It's wonderful to stretch out in your bed, this nice soft mattress and this nice comfortable blankets and pillow. It's wonderful, isn't it? Why do you want to waste all that pleasure by going to sleep? Just lay there and enjoy every moment of it. So if you do that, if you try to stay awake, you can't stay awake, you've got to sleep straight away. So the point of it is, you toss and turn because you're trying too hard to go to sleep. So this is just like a skill for me, just playing around. So it's wonderful, I'm just going to be like this all night. So just lay down and just allow the mind to be still. In the present moment means you're not counting time. You don't care, you know, what the next minute is going to be. Just this moment now is all. And when you're not filling the mind with fear of the future, you will not toss and turn. And you're going to sleep, and you're going to sleep very deeply. Because you're going to sleep with calm, peaceful mind states for meditation. Which means you don't need to sleep so long. And you wake up in the morning, and then you're just so bright. You may have only been a couple of hours sleep, but because you've gone into sleep with a very peaceful mind state, the mind just really rests, and so does the body. It's good to meditate, but this is sleeping. Now, trying to sleep, and that's usually the problem there. You've got a bit of energy coming from the meditation, but you don't know how to allow that energy just to go into silence, go into stillness, and allow your body to go to sleep. That makes sense? This is how to go to sleep. Supposed to be teaching how to keep awake. Could you please speak a little on patience and loving-kindness? Thanks very much. They're both the same thing. Patience, loving-kindness, letting go is all the same. It's just coming from different angles. If you're really patient, you just got to allow things to be for a while. And this is one of the lovely things about meditation, that patience is the fastest way. You just sit here and just let go. And allow things to happen. The more you try and make it happen, the more time you are wasting. You do more doing, more controlling. Remember that this is not a control-free meditation retreat. And you can see this, that I'm not a control freak. You can see that just the way that we structured this meditation retreat, I'm giving you heaps and heaps of freedom, absolute freedom. We do that on purpose. And now, don't teach meditation retreats like this just to be soft and to be nice to people. Now, I could be fierce and say, okay, get up at 3 o'clock tomorrow morning and sit, don't move, and go behind you with a big stick like in the Zen monastery and whack you one when you sort of nod. But that doesn't get you anywhere. That's just more control. It's not letting go. I know that's, I've been to these retreats. I went to one of these retreats when I was a student. And this was in a monastery in the north of England. It's still there. It's Russell Hole, probably. I think it was a Zen monastery. And I was sitting there on a Saturday morning. You know, just I was a student. You know, I just didn't sleep much, you know, when you're a student. And you go to this retreat centre Saturday morning. Everyone was sleepy. Well, I had good karma. I was fortunate. The guy sitting next to me was more sleepy than I was. So he got hit. And after he got here, I wasn't sleepy at all. The people said it didn't hurt, but I wasn't convinced. But I was awake out of fear. Anyway, that wasn't really, that's not what I went to a meditation retreat for. So instead of doing that, patience is much better. So allow yourself to be sleepy if you're sleepy. Be patient, sleep will disappear. You come here with sleep deficit, which I think is the right term, because you've been pushing yourself too hard. As I was pushing myself too hard last week, didn't have much choice about it, because you don't have much choice. You get tired. Allow yourself to go to sleep if you're tired. You're not controlling it, you're not forcing it. And that's also loving kindness. It's patience, it's letting go, it's kindness. Be kind to yourself. Be compassionate to yourself. And be like a mother to yourself, your only child. So when you're kind and soft to yourself, and that's the beautiful way to get into deep states of meditation. You don't get into deep states of meditation just by being like, you know, the Rambo of the meditation retreat, just killing all the defilements, and I'm going to really sit really strong here, I'm going to stay up all night. Yeah. I've seen monks like that, they go crazy. So this loving kindness is this beautiful softness of the mind. This is what the Buddha did for 6 years with his ascetic practices. You know, just like being the tough guy, being Masha, And this will get you anywhere. And that's why the Buddha said his very first teaching was the middle way. Before he taught the Four Noble Truths, middle way. Don't go to the extremes of torturing yourself, pushing yourself too hard. Have this beautiful loving kindness, which actually guides the body and guides the mind gently through the meditation retreat. It's interesting that when the Buddha actually started practicing that, his five companions didn't understand what he was doing. In fact, they got so fed up with him, they thought he was just slacking off. Just the same way that sometimes when you go and have a rest in the afternoon, people think, oh, you're just slacking off. Don't worry what other people think, because the Buddha had the courage to not worry what other people think when his five disciples just left him, abandoned him, because they thought he was being soft. He knew what he was doing. He knew that was a path of enlightenment. With kindness and compassion to his body. Through being patient, giving the thing time. First meditation teacher, he told me that lovely story of when he was in Bangkok and his father gave him some seeds to plant in the ground. For the first time in his life he had something to grow. And of course, you know, in Southeast Asia you put things in the ground, they grow very easily. But nevertheless, he would water them every day. But being a small child, after about 6 or 7 years of age, I forget what, after about 5 or 6 days, he became impatient. When are these flowers going to start growing? So he went and told his father. And his father says, don't worry, because the seeds have probably germinated by now. They're growing underground. You can't see them, but I guarantee that they're growing. And that gave him enough confidence to keep on going for another couple of days. And he saw this, when the first little green shoots start poking up above the ground. He was so excited. He started to water those plants twice a day. And they grew and they grew, and it was about 2 inches high. That's when he lost his patience. He decided to stretch those plants to make them grow faster. And he killed every one. But he learned a lesson in patience. You can't stretch plants to make them grow faster. In the same way, you can't stretch meditation to make it come faster. You have to be patient to nurture the mind, to nurture the body, to nurture meditation, just like a gardener. And so many great teachers of our tradition have used those similes, like the gardener looking after a tree. Your job is to water that tree, a bit of fertilizer every now and again, listen to a Dharma talk, and to guard it. That's all. And it grows all by itself. That's what patience is. Looking after it is loving kindness. Patience is leaving it alone, giving it time to grow. Letting go is stop interfering with it. Stop stretching it and pulling it this way and that. So actually, loving kindness and patience and letting go, they're exactly the same. That's why, my definition of loving kindness, the door of my heart's open to you no matter who you are, no matter what you've done. That's letting go. If you die, if you come up and say, this is the worst meditation retreat, this is a lot of old rubbish, Adam Brahm, I'm going, I still, the door of my heart's always open to you. It's called letting you go. Letting people come there, people be there, people go. Or you have a really terrible meditation, and I come up here in the morning, I just fall asleep, and I snore in front of all of you, and I'm supposed to be the great meditation teacher, and I think, ah, it doesn't matter about Ajahn Brahm, if you really stuff up this retreat, the door of my heart is still open to me, I don't care. This is actually being patient, letting go, not measuring yourself, not controlling, not judging, no craving. No attachment. When you have that degree of love and kindness, you can see how it gives you freedom and letting go and patience. And after a while, everything comes right in this meditation because you're putting in the causes. Those causes which give rise to freedom, which are defined, as I said last night, in the Third Noble Truth. You're doing the Third Noble Truth meditation, letting go, loving kindness, patience. They all come from the same place and they all lead to the same goal. It's stillness, peace, freedom. So in this retreat, don't forget loving kindness. This is a loving kindness retreat. Don't forget patience. It's a patience retreat. My goodness, you've got another 8 days to go, yeah? So don't get in line today, otherwise you'll have nothing to do for the next 8 days. So leave in line until the end. That's really good. So be patient. Okay. Any comments on that? Okay, next one. Ajahn, can you please let us know what climate, what drink, e.g. Milo, milk, are permissible when one is on 8 precepts? Are we on 8 precepts, or are we just not having an evening meal? Thank you. Okay, 8 precepts is, especially the 6th precept, is not having anything solid in the evening. We call it bhojana. And because the monks have that same precept, and in the monks' rules of conduct, it's described at length, in great detail. In fact, that this is one of the jokes that we tell each other in the monastery. The monks argue more about what goes into the mouth than what comes out of it. In other words, about food. This is another joke in northeast Thailand. When two young monks under 5 reins get together, or junior monks, they always talk about food, which monastery's got the best food. Any monks over 10 reins talk about building. That's what he used to say in the world. It's actually quite true. But when it comes to actually the what goes in the mouth in the afternoon, it's just really, it's like solid food. Basically, grains, the no-no. But when it comes to milk, it wasn't actually mentioned yes or no. And you have to actually use inference to find out, was milk allowable or is it not allowable? And even now, some monks say, yes, it is allowable. Some monks say, no, it isn't allowable. And so it is grey area. And so because it's grey, out of compassion, sort of I allow people on 8 precepts to take milk in the afternoon on a retreat. But as a monastery rule, which is excellent in 8 precepts, in monastery in Bodhinyana, we don't have milk in the afternoon. But here, those people, other than the Anagarikas in our monastery, they can have milk in the afternoon. So with these, the rules of vinaya, sometimes you can get to the rules of precepts. Sometimes you can get so picky about, what does it exactly mean, exactly what is allowable, what isn't allowable, and it just makes life miserable. And so because of that, even the Buddha, which, for example, we had some, in our rooms over there, we have some butterscotch sweets. And they've got a bit of cream in it, isn't it? 8% cream. And this is very similar to in the time of the Buddha, when there was some sugar which had some flour in it. And so one of the monks said, is this allowed, is it not? And his answer, which is from the vinaya, from the Buddha's words, says, what's the flour in there for? And he says, only just to harden it. Harden the sugar. I said, what's it called? Is it called flour? Is it called sugar? Is it still called sugar? I said, if it's still called sugar, then treat it as sugar. If it's still called butterscotch, then treat it as butterscotch. In other words, what the Buddha was saying is, don't make too much of a fuss and bother about these things. Be reasonable. Don't go trying to find out all the ingredients and if it's 0.001% of something which is unallowable. Right, that's it. Don't eat that, otherwise you'll turn into a toad. So just the milk is okay and the Milo is okay for you, as long as you're not having a big meal, then it's okay. The same with sometimes there's some people on this retreat who have said to take some yogurt or something in the evening because they need, or a sandwich or something, because they have these medicines they can't eat on an empty stomach. Remember what these 8 precepts are there for? It's just for simplicity, not for torture. So it means we just finish with the eating all in one go in the morning. Two meals, and after lunch we've got all this wonderful time, the whole afternoon and evening. We don't have to worry about cooking and washing up and all that sort of stuff. But that's the only reason we do this, for the sake of simplicity. You've got more time. It's amazing just how much time is taken up through eating. And very, actually just I often When are you? That only takes about 10 minutes, 15 minutes. I eat quite fast. And how many hours do people take actually cooking that food? For just 10 minutes of shoving this stuff down your throat, it takes hours and hours and hours for people actually to make that food, to plow the land, to grow it, to transport it, to clean it, to package it, to buy it, to cook it, to clean up afterwards. Really, it's a waste of time, I think. So it's marvellous if we can just get it all out in one go and have done with it. One of our monasteries in Thailand, years and years ago, the head monk, only about 3 months or 4 months in this monastery, he just would have a bucket, a big bucket, with yesterday's leftovers in it, and whoever brought whatever the next day, he'd put it all in the bucket, and he'd sort of stir it all up, take a few dollops himself and pass it down for the rest. He'd take as many dollops as he liked. And what was left over was put in the fridge afterwards, and whatever got cooked or bought the next day got into the bucket and read again. So it's for 3 months. Shall we try that? Oh, come on. Tell you the food. That's what you used to do. You didn't have many marks left. That's your jitter. So just like keep it simple and keep it easy and don't wet your woes, and that's about it. Any problem about that? Okay, next question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, inner talk always disturbs the meditation. Yes. Okay, that's true. That's why the inner talk is thinking. I've already mentioned that already. See if you could quieten that down. If you want a skillful means to quieten that down, you can always do that technique, which is always fun for me to teach, of watching the gaps between the words when I'm speaking. You're not supposed to laugh, you're supposed to listen. Because whenever I speak like this, in the gaps, you're silent. Because you have to actually wait to see what I'm going to say next. That you're not thinking. There is silence there. So it's a very good technique, especially for those that are beginning meditation. Because one, they don't know what silence is, and number two, they don't think they can be silent. But silence happens very often. But we can't recognize it. We don't know when we're silent. We only know when we're thinking. So because of that, a little technique like that, a little exercise like that, shows you that yes, you are silent very often. And it also means you can actually think, speak to yourself like I just spoke to you. And just listen to the gap between the words. There, that's silence. That's what it means. Once you recognize it, and once you get to know it, it grows and grows and grows. And you can wait along. Isn't that nice? There, you are silent. It's easy. So you can talk like that to yourself until you get to know what silence is. Don't talk like that when you go home next week, otherwise they think you're crazy. And that's actually how you can stop the inner talk. Now and again, it's okay to interrupt the meditation, just to give a nudge here and a nudge there. But when you actually interrupt, if it's just a one word or two words, it doesn't actually disturb at all, it just guides. You just say, just like calm. Or just shh. Or just kindness. I just every now, just one word in the middle of a meditation can do lots and lots of good. It's just reminding you. But it's only like a little nudge. Make it just one word rather than a whole sentence, or a whole paragraph, or a whole essay. Otherwise, you lose it all. But every now and again, if it's just a little nudge, then that doesn't disturb meditation at all, but actually helps it along. Because you see what's going on, you see what's needed. It's just like a little coach at the sidelines, who's encouraging you, who's guiding you. Okay, next question. You said to watch the breath, eventually at the point, like the saw touching at that same point as it moves forward and backwards. How do we do that? Do we watch the whole breath and find that point where the in and out breath touches, then focus our attention there on? Or do we keep on watching the whole breath and eventually there is a change? Okay, and the second one is the right answer to this. Because you don't do things, allow it to happen. Again, I mentioned this morning that these are stages of the meditation which happens quite naturally. So I'm not telling you a technique to do this and do this and do this and do this. I'm describing the stages of a journey. After this, you'll find this. After that, you'll find that. After that, you'll find something else. So I'm describing the stages of a journey with these stages of meditation. And it's all stages of letting go. More and more and more. A very powerful technique which I use in meditation, which I've been using already this week, is going in to the next stage of the meditation, rather than on to the next stage of meditation. There's a very powerful difference between going on to the next stage. Going on to the next stage means like going on into the next room. You leave this room to go into another room. You leave that room to go into the next room. In meditation, you don't leave this room. You go deeper into this room to get to the next stage. Deeper in to this. That means you don't throw away what you have now. You never throw away anything. Even if it's thinking, you just go right to the centre of that thinking, to the middle of it, and there is silence. You go right to the middle of time. It's the present moment. I should have done that first. Right to the middle of the present moment is silence. Right in the middle of silence, you'll find your breath. Don't try get rid of the silence and then go on to the breath. Find the breath in the middle of that silence, where you are now. In the middle of the breath, you'll find the beautiful breath. This is this wonderful piece of breath happening now. That tooth, which is touching the wood, is in the middle of the saw. It's not in another saw. You don't have to get rid of the saw to find that next stage. It's right in the centre of things. So you're always centering, going into the middle of things. The middle of this, the middle of the middle of this, the middle of the middle of the middle. Keep going in, not on. When you go into the middle of the beautiful breath, that's where you find the limiters, beautiful lights. You don't get rid of the beautiful breath. You don't say, okay, I've done the breath now, let's go to the limiters. You stay with the beautiful breath, and right in the centre, you find limiters coming up. That's why that if you're on that stage where you've got limiters and the breath, just one thing and the other, and you haven't really sort of made the transition from the breath to the limiters, sometimes you could just hold a limiter in the middle with the breath outside of it, just like holding sort of a microphone in my hands. This is the breath, the limiter is in the middle. So you've just still got the perception of both things there. The beautiful breath and the limiter. But it's the beautiful limiter is in the middle of the beautiful breath. When you go into the middle of the limiters, you get even more beautiful limiters. You go right to the very centre of that limiter. That's where the jhanas lie. So you never actually get rid of anything. You never cast away what you're experiencing now. You just go deeper into it. So actually, that's actually how the meditation happens. Always going in. And that's the best way. So you never actually give up anything. You never do anything. You stop doing. You sink deeper into the moment, deeper into the breath, deeper into the nimittas, deeper into the mind. So actually this is, to watch the whole breath and find that point where the in and out breath touches. Then to focus attention on that. You just keep watching the whole breath. And go into the whole breath. Just keep on going into the moment. And you'll find that it will just happen all by itself. As it goes in more and more, focusing in more and more. Then you'll find the breath disappears. Where's in gone? Where's out gone? Both have disappeared. It's just breath. It's beautiful breath. And just beautiful, no breath anymore. Just beautiful, that means an imiter. And then you keep on going that way. It's an important point in meditation, always going in, centering. Never throw away what you're experiencing now to get up to the next stage. Never throw away anything, you just go into it more and more. That's why if you've got a really crazy mind, don't try and stop that crazy mind. Throw it away to get into silence. Go right into the centre of it. That's the way you find the silence. That's the way you stop that mind. Going into the middle of it. Okay, next, any comment on that question? Yeah, go on. Yeah, the thing is, you don't try and concentrate on anything, you don't stop concentrating on anything. All the trying, the doing, is just let that one go. You're just being a passive observer, watching all of this. So it's as if like you're watching a movie, and you can't tell the director, it's already shot, you're just watching there. You can't even flip the channels anymore, you're stuck with this. So just keep watching, be passive, and just the slight nudge, go in. Centering. So it's just that nudge to the mind into the middle of these things. So this is actually how we do. Be very careful not to control the meditation and keep doing it, because that disturbs it and you can't go very deep that way. You just nudge the mind into the center, it just goes by itself. But the point being here, there is that stage, as my meditation is anyway, where before the nimitta comes up, there's certainly the nimitta and the breath. And I develop a perception of, and I'm almost looking upon the breath like a donut, with the middle being the nimitta. So, you know, just the stage, the breath is still there, but so is the nimitta coming up in the middle of it. I just leave it, I'm just passively aware of it. But there's a little bit of a nudge to the center. And when it's ready, it just goes into the center, into the limiter, and the breath just disappears. And it's a lovely little visual metaphor, because you can imagine a lot of concentric rings. Now outside the beautiful breath is the ordinary breath, and the ring around the beautiful breath. Around the ordinary breath is silence, and around silence is this big ring of present moment. And around the present moment is a big sphere of the world, with its time, with its business and everything else. You go in to these concentric circles. Does that make sense? Okay, next question here. Why do I start rocking sideways or back and forth when I'm meditating? This happens when I seem to flick into a certain zone of my mind. Please explain. Okay, I'm not quite sure what the zone is. If it's sleepiness, if that's the zone you're getting into, that just leave it alone, because you know you all get sleepy from time to time. When you're sleepy, sometimes you rock backwards and forwards. That's just natural. That's why especially as you know, young monks or young novice monks especially, they're always sort of when we have these long all night sits or these ceremonies which went on all night, there'd always be one novice. We always look for that, so being sort of naughty young monks, I remember at the time, we'd always look for you know, the novice at the end of the line. When they started rocking, we'd nudge each other, because we'd always be sitting high up on these benches in Thailand, in these ceremonies. And you know, all the ceremonies, I must admit, were quite boring most of the time, so this was actually the entertainment for the night, because they'd be sitting on the bench, and they'd be rocking, only be a matter of time before they fall off. We're just waiting for it, we're excited, who'd go first? And of course, you know, we're wearing robes like these, when they did fall off, you know, you could see anything, literally. and that was the entertainment for the night. And there's four little knots, so embarrassed. But that's what happens sometimes, we just start rocking and like that. And I used to do that quite a lot when I was a young monk. So what I used to do, I used to put this matchbox on top of my head to try and stop me. You get a matchbox and you take the cover off and just put it on your head. So it means that when you started rocking, you know, it means the matchbox will fall off. and make a noise. So that was actually to tell you whether you're rotting or not. And it worked for me, because after a while the matchbox wouldn't fall off at all. And I thought, oh great, I've got over sleepiness. And then one of the monks took me aside and said, I've been watching you, Ajahn Brahm. He said that when you meditate, you still rock, but instead of rocking like this, you rock like this. Your body is amazing, you can't really go, okay, enough of that. That is just the nature of the mind. So, just allow that, if you're doing rocking, just leave it alone. After a while, the body will settle. But it's interesting, a lot of times that people say they're rocking, but they're not. They think they are, it's just the mind playing games, that's all. And, I've known this because sometimes people have this problem, they come and tell me about it, so I make a resolution to open my eyes and see, watch them. And they're sitting absolutely straight. But it appears that you're rocking inside of you. It's just the mind playing games. So if that happens, just forget about it. It's okay to rock. It's not against the 8 precepts. and that way that you can just forget about it. When you forget about it, it's not a problem. Then it disappears. It's all gone. So when it happens, sometimes it could be sleepiness. If it's sleepiness, just go and take a rest. Or have a cup of tea or something. Give yourself a break. And if it is something else, for example, it's not sleepiness, but you're getting quite peaceful. It's just the mind is deceiving you. So don't even worry about it. Let the body go. It doesn't matter if you're walking. Just leave it alone. Sometimes people think they're leaning to the side. But they're not, they're absolutely straight. It's just the mind deceiving you. So when you understand that, just don't even worry about it. And the whole perception of leaning to the left or leaning to the right will just disappear. The body is an amazing thing, but after a while the body will decide how you're sitting. It's happened to me with this business of posture, how should you sit? Sometimes I used to be very tired, and especially in the hot weather of Thailand, it's very humid, very tiring. And it always slump. And then I was paying complete attention. I was very mindful. And then just my body straightened up all by itself. That's the first, it's happened many times since. And it was very amazing because I didn't do it. I didn't give the order. I didn't will it. It just straightened up all by itself. And from that time onwards, I realized that you can just leave the body alone and it will choose the right posture when it wants to. It's an automatic process. And so what happens then, if you are leaning to the left, if the body wants to lean to the left, let it lean to the left, if that's what it wants to do. It will correct itself later on if it needs to. If the head is too far back, or too far forward, or too far back, it will correct itself. You don't need to worry about it. Here's the main message here. You just leave it alone, and the body will look after the body. Your job is to look after the mind. And the body does it all by itself. So many of you, I hope, have experienced that. You're sitting here and suddenly you're alert, aware, and the body moves by itself. Just the body self-balancing. Make sense? Okay, next question. We're going really quickly. Here we go. Talking about getting higher, reaching jhanas, enlightenment, etc. sounds goal-orientated. Yeah. Please comment. Is it sufficient just to accept what happens in meditation, i.e. how it is good enough, jhana or no jhana? Well, actually, the whole of Buddhism is goal-orientated. It's getting enlightened, isn't it? That's what you're supposed to be doing. But it's to be able to get that goal, you have to be very sharp and very wise, because the point of this question is that how can you actually reach for a goal without getting into craving and desire? And this is explained by understanding the goal of Buddhism, the goal of meditation is letting go. It's the goal of no goal. So unless you're not trying to be smart and outset and Zen people, it's just the goal of no goal is actually trying, or rather finding the means, so you don't set yourself goals. So you let go. So you just sit here and allow things to happen. And sometimes if we don't actually set the goal of no goal, if we don't set the parameters of letting go, you just say, do whatever you want in this retreat, then you won't let go. You just wander around all over the place as we normally do. So giving the direction of letting go, abandoning, renunciation is telling you to do nothing. And you have to sort of sometimes direct the person to do nothing, otherwise the normal way of doing things is always doing things. So here, like, there is a goal, but we have to know what that goal is, the goal of no goal, and also the means to achieving it. It's like bliss is almost like your birthright. It's just right underneath everything. You just need to uncover it. You don't actually make bliss or fetch bliss from somewhere else. It's right inside this moment. That's where enlightenment is. You just almost need to uncover it. So that's actually the goal of uncovering, letting go of the covers which blind one to seeing the truth. So that's why that sometimes when talk about jhanas, it happens that every now and again somebody gets a jhana in their life and they have such a terrible difficulty getting it again. And that happens to many, many people. And it's very interesting to find out why, what's going on here. And it is because the first time you get into a deep meditation, now you've done the right thing, you've let go, you haven't done anything, you've abandoned. You haven't sort of to aim for anything. But then once you've had it once, you forget the causes. You just go for the goal again, rather than remembering the causes. The causes which gave rise to that achievement. And so that when one forgets the causes, one goes trying, and you never gets anywhere. You realize when you talk about jhana or enlightenment, these are stages of letting go. So make the causes, put all the causes in place. And the causes are like virtue, which is letting go of stupidity in body and speech. Put forth the causes of letting go of doing. Present moment awareness, silence, just watching the breath. Put all the causes in place and these things happen by themselves. This is actually what we mean by the goal, is making the causes which give rise to that goal. And those causes are all letting go, non-doing. So I hope that's quite clear there. So it is literally a goal of no goal. But actually needs to make a goal of that. Otherwise you never achieve it. So just sitting here, allowing things to stop. Patient, loving kindness, letting go. And the stages which I've mentioned there, just so you can find your way. You know where you are, you know how things are going, you know what to do, or rather what not to do. Always centering, going in, letting go. Loving kindness. And that's the way to actually to achieve these states. There is an achievement, there is something to be done. But it's done through letting go, not through attaching. Does that make sense? Is that unclear? So there is a goal of nirvana, but there is, in a sense, at the end of goals. That's why that you've heard me say before, the two types of freedom. The freedom of desire and the freedom from desire. We're talking about contentment, the freedom from desire. You have to aspire to such freedom for it to happen. And then you have to give up that aspiration, because that's also part of desire. Put in the causes, and all the effects eventually happen. Okay, that's the last question today. Went very quick. Has anyone got any questions from the floor? Yeah, go on.
At this point, I want to just talk about the causal conditions for letting go when you step before the mastermind. The first one is the rally, the last one is not letting anything stick in the mind, but I can't remember the other two.
Yeah, the other two, one was freedom. And you've heard me say before that freedom comes from contentment. Because, you know, the simile I said before, that story about the monk who went to jail to give talks, and they describe what the monastery was like, and the prisoners, I won't go into detail of that story, I've said it many times, and the prisoners said, "That's terrible in your monastery, why don't you come in here and stay with us?" And the purpose of that story was, why is a monastery not a jail when it's much tougher than any jail? You only get 2 meals a day if you're lucky. You even have to work on rocks. Well, they stopped working with rock work in sort of jails years ago. You have to sleep on the floor sometimes. So really tough in a monastery. But why is it that people always like, you know, you've been to the stay-at-home monastery, Chris, sometimes you can't get a place to stay there. You've got to book in for weeks basically to get into the place. But not in a prison. You have to book for weeks to get out. So what's the difference between a prison and a monastery? It's not the comfort. It's not like the physical happiness of the place. It's whether you want to be there or not. That's the whole difference between being free and being in a prison. If you're happy to be where you are, it's not a prison. You're free. If you're content to be here. So this is what I mean by letting go. It doesn't mean like getting rid of all the pains and aches in your body. It doesn't mean like stopping all of your thoughts. It's being content. So when the thoughts come, you go right to center of those. Allow them to be. Let go. And you're content to have a wandering mind. Then you're free from the wandering mind. It all stops. You're content just to be with this stupid old breath. Sometimes you see it, sometimes you don't. If you're really content, then you become free from desire. The force which makes the mind move is taken away. So this is what we mean, the way of letting go through contentment. That's why, I don't know what sort of day you've had today. Whatever it is, don't judge it. It had to be this way. Be content with it. When you're content with it, you're free. You're not judging yourself. You're not forcing yourself. You're not the control freak anymore. No craving. All craving and thinking comes from discontent. So that contentment is the meaning of freedom. And you know, sometimes you think this retreat is a prison. We've got walls, we've got routines, we've got this. Be content. And then you find this is the freest place in the world. Sometimes people ask me what it's like to be a monk. They can't believe you can be happy as a monk. All these things you can't do. All these things which you have to do. You know, sometimes they think, you've got no freedom, Ajahn Brahm. You've got to give a talk here, you've got to give a talk there. And your time's all taken up with other people. You never have any free time for yourself. So I'm as free as I want. If I'm content, then I'm free. If I say, why do I have to teach this retreat again? Why do I have to ask this other question? They asked me this question before. Why do I have to answer the phone, this crazy lady who's having problems with this husband or whatever? Why is it always me? Why is it always me who has to go to these house blessings? Why is it always me who has to do this? It's very easy to do things like that. But of course, that's not how to be happy. So you're content. Oh, isn't it wonderful? I have the chance to teach a retreat again. Isn't it wonderful I have the chance to speak to somebody on the phone because they're in pain? Isn't it wonderful that I got a chance to go to somebody's house to give them a blessing? Isn't it wonderful that I can help with all this work for Waysak ceremony this year? Isn't it wonderful after this retreat I can go to Sydney and help do some teaching over there? And that's what happened after this retreat. I rushed off to the airport to go to Sydney to do some more meditation. Isn't it wonderful? So that way I'm not in a prison. This is what you've been taught as a monk. Learning how to be content with little. With the food you have in your bowl. With the place you have to sleep. With the duties which are assigned to you. Then you are free. It doesn't matter how much you have to do. Whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. It's the attitude of contentment or, I don't want this, why me? So all of you who are having to chop up the vegetables. You have to make the monk's breakfast. You have to, you know, clean up the toilets, whatever your job is. If you don't want to do it, if you're trying to get rid of it, to get back to your meditation, you haven't understood what meditation is, what contentment is. So with contentment, then you're free. That's letting go. And Patty Nisiga was the other one, Chris, who's just like throwing things away. Things, see how much stuff you can throw in the dustbin. All of your past, all of your future, all of these thoughts, all of these crazy things, all the possessions, everything you own. See, what do I own? And throw that away. So it becomes someone who doesn't own anything. It's a nice little meditation there. What do I own? And then throw it away. What else do I own? And throw that away. See how much you can be someone who owns nothing. Absolutely nothing. You don't own, not even your ability in meditation. Not a good meditator or a bad meditator. You don't own your intelligence. You don't own anything. That's freedom. That's letting go. See how much you can let go. So those are the other two ways of letting go. Non-ownership. And what was the other one? About freedom, contentment. Okay, and it's 9 o'clock. So, now is the time for whatever. So if you want to carry on meditating, carry on meditating. You want to sort of go to sleep, go to sleep. If you want to go have a cup of tea, cup of coffee, have a cup of tea, cup of coffee. The night is still young. It is. It's late, 9 o'clock. It's sometimes on a Friday night. Sometimes people stay up till 11, 12, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. Just down the road in Northbridge there, the people are still partying till 3 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock all night. They don't get tired. So this is Ajahn Brahm's nightclub. So have fun, enjoy yourself. But if you get tired, go to sleep. Don't worry about what the time is. If you really want to keep meditating till late in the night, please do so. You can always sleep tomorrow morning.